Thank you, Sue, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for June 12. This is the third of three oral arguments that we're having today. This one by Zoom. The two previous matters were held in courtroom 200 here at the Judicial Center. Judges Bjorkman and Smith join me, Judge Sleater, in file A23-1254, State of Minnesota as appellant. Terry Aziel Heggs, respondent. We are recording this proceeding as well as live streaming it. So we do ask counsel when you begin your statements to identify yourself for our record and who you represent. There will be an audio recording available on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours. So all other recording is prohibited. Counsel, we each have 15 minutes for your comments and then 5 minutes rebuttal for appellant. So with those statements, counsel for appellant, if you identify yourself, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Good morning, counsel. My name is Heather Jo Schmidt, and I am an assistant Maurer County attorney representing the state in the instant case. Your Honors, the jury correctly found the respondent guilty of domestic assault and violation of his predatory offender registration requirements. The evidence here is sufficient to sustain those guilty verdicts, and we would request that this court reverse the district court's judgment of acquittal and reinstate the jury's verdict. The standard of review here, as I'm sure you know, is de novo, and a court will not overturn a jury verdict without significant justification. This reflects the substantial deference that this court accords jury verdicts. Now, of course, here there is circumstantial evidence for both of these charges, offenses, and verdicts. And when such circumstantial evidence is before the Court of Appeals, there is a two-part test that first, the identification of all the circumstances proved must be viewed with deference to the jury's verdict and rejection of any evidence in the record that would conflict those verdicts. Then second,
Ms. Schmidt, I'm sorry to interrupt. My question that I wanted to ask you about the circumstantial evidence, what evidence, and this would be the first step, circumstances proved, was that he occasionally resides there? And by that, I specifically, I guess I'm adding too, is what's your understanding of the law of how often he would need to stay there to be occasionally, and how was that evidence presented under the circumstances proved in this case?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And I believe that I addressed that direct question in my respondents, my reply to respondents' brief, because he did bring up that question. We had two witnesses that testified on the definition of occasional or regular. I think the state can concede that it wasn't a regular occurrence that Mr. Heggs, the defendant here, would have stayed at the Wing Bazaar restaurant, but we definitely believe that there is circumstantial evidence that he stayed there occasionally. There is a plethora of evidence that he stayed there the night preceding the incident based on his dress, the flower on his boxers, that of course he wasn't the only one there at that time. But in addition, there is evidence that he stayed there more than just that one time. And I believe that Agent Booth testified that in her experience as an agent with an expertise in that area, that occasionally means 2 to 3 times, 3 to 4 times, not so much a pattern to constitute regular, but less than a pattern to constitute occasionally. And the evidence for that is this. There were other boxer shorts that were found there, meaning that he stayed there more than one evening. The bathroom seemed to be used as a shower or a washing station with more than one, I believe, shower towels. There was one on the shelf in the break room area. There was also one in the bathroom. The amount of personal items, also hair products, more than just a deodorant if you would just stay one night at a time, but hair products, Other items, a razor. One a man I don't think would need to shave every single day, but the razor was there. It shows that the person was there more than a few nights in a row. There's also other items that were definitely suspect, and that Detective Walsky testified would be part of a living situation, more like a motel or apartment, such as an iron.
Counsel, even if we agree with you that there was sufficient evidence, and the only rational inference would be that someone was occasionally staying overnight at the restaurant, why is it only to be inferred that the man who stayed occasionally was the respondent?
Well, definitely, we think that the evidence shows that respondent did stay there. Now, whether or not other persons stayed overnight could have happened, but that is not dispositive to whether the defendant here would have also stayed overnight. And
And
we connect the defendant.
what's the strongest evidence that it was in fact the respondent who occasionally stayed overnight, rather than some other man who would have used hair care products and worn men's clothing?
Certainly. Well, the fact that he was found before the restaurant opened in his underwear, that the bed clothes were recently slept in, that his personal mail was found at the Wing Bazaar restaurant, and it wasn't such mail that one would bring to a restaurant or an office unless they were planning to stay there for a number of days. These were items that were like a suitcase full, I believe, is what Detective Walsky testified to. They were strewn throughout the break room. Mr. Higgs wouldn't leave those lying around if he wasn't there on a consistent basis. And he wouldn't bring them from his home unless. Because some of them, and I believe this is in a respondent's brief, were dated from 2014, 2015. So the question arises, someone wouldn't bring those from their home and strew them around a break room unless they were comfortable being there for a period of time. I hope that answers your question.
Ms. Schmidt, can I follow up on that? Was there some evidence in the record in terms of how often he works, and or perhaps there was a manager or something explained the availability of it? Was there, and how what the relationship of his primary residence is to this place, such that it would give additional inference that while he's working, he stays there?
There wasn't any contradictory evidence as to anyone else that could have been staying at the Wing Bazaar. Defense did not bring any other employees to the stand. They didn't bring his boss or his manager to say, "Hey, other people live there." No one took the stand that said, "We also stay overnight, and hey, this is my hair care product, and that's my towel." There was no evidence that contradicted that this was Mr. Higgs that was staying at the Wing Bazaar. So I hope that answers your question too. Was it there a second part to that question?
Well, I was assuming that his need to stay there must have something to do with the distance from his primary residence and his work hours, et cetera.
Yes, thank you for that. Yes, there was. He changed his register, and this is found in registration documents. I believe it's Exhibit 21 and 23. The BCA registration documents say that he moved from Austin as his primary residence to Albert Lea. So there is that difference in place where he would need to stay overnight. Let's say he's got the evening shift, they close, and then he opens in the morning. It's completely reasonable that Mr. Higgs would stay at the Wing Bazaar overnight. And although he did put on those same BCA documents that it was his work address correctly, he did not indicate that he would be staying overnight there, which of course is important to law enforcement and the reason why we have the predatory offender registration requirements.
So we know from the record that the police investigated the 911 call at, I think it was 7:55 a.m. on November 19th. And I understand that a few days later, when they executed the search warrant later, 10:40, something like that in the morning, is there evidence in the record of what the restaurant hours of operation were?
I don't believe there is any evidence in the record regarding the hours. I do believe that Detective Walsky testified that he had to get the key to the restaurant to execute that search warrant from Mr. Higgs, who was currently, I still believe, in custody at the time. But that's all I know about that. Regarding the burden and the standard of review, and the jury. I would like to talk about the jury a little bit first and then talk about the domestic assault charge since we haven't had the opportunity to talk about that yet. The jury, of course, is the finder of fact, and they are in the best position to evaluate the credibility of the testimony of the victim. Here, we did have an uncooperative victim, which unfortunately is not uncommon in a domestic violence situation. If your honors would turn your attention after the oral arguments to document 99, which includes the voir dire of the jury here, and specifically at pages 171 through 174, the jurors were asked about their experience with domestic violence. Violence and brought up that emotional control over a victim could affect one's testimony, especially when they're looking at that defendant in the courtroom and being judged by 12 strangers. And particularly in this case, the jury could see the tone of the victim's voice, the cadence of the words that she said, her mannerisms, and how she interacted with the defendant in the courtroom, which is why, of course, the jury is in the best position to determine the credibility of the witness, and that credibility determinations should be viewed with deference to the jury, even in circumstantial evidence cases, because they are the finder of fact. And I believe that even in those circumstantial evidence cases, as shown in the State v. Janicek case, which I cite in my primary brief.
Counsel, on the domestic abuse charge, what's the strongest evidence that would support a jury concluding that the respondent intended to and or did cause bodily harm to the complaining victim?
Yes, Your Honor. And first, I'd like to mention the causal or the intention that needs to be proved here. Because it is domestic assault harm, it is a general intent crime, meaning that the defendant had to do the purpose, had the purpose to do the thing or the result specified, but does not need to, let me just find my citation here. They don't need to know that what they are doing is against the law. So Mr. Higgs needed to do an act, but he didn't need to know that that act would have caused the harm, the result that occurred, i.e., the bloody lip. So in the specific answer to your question, Your Honor, I think the words that Ms. Wilson said are very important to that element of the case. Now, the jury interpreted those words one way, and the judge interpreted those words a different way. But if you just read the words on the black and white page, you don't have her mannerisms and her voice and the way she looked and made eye contact or lack thereof with the defendant. But then, in addition to that, you have other circumstances that can infer that domestic assault, did happen. She said that, the fight was somewhat physical, that she received the bloody lip from the fighting. She also said that the fighting was face to face in close contact, and all of those inferences are made. However, we also have the victim's demeanor, which I've mentioned before. There was the fact that there was a 911 call made, so there was a reason that the victim made that call. The jury saw photos of the bloody lip. They also heard the officer's testimony based on what they heard and saw when they arrived at the Wing Bazaar restaurant. They saw photos of the flower. They saw the sock in the flower indicating that a physical scuffle had occurred. They saw Ms. Wilson's body print up against the refrigerator door, indicating that there could have been more physical fighting, close to close, face to face contact, as the victim testified to. Now, her testimony is vague at some points, and I do see that my time is up. So I would just ask that this court reverse the judgment of acquittal and reinstate the guilty verdicts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. And you will have 5 minutes rebuttal should you choose to do so. And so now we'll turn to Mr. Erickson on behalf of the respondent. You may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the respondent this morning, Mr. Heggs. We are asking that this court affirm the district court's judgment of acquittal on both counts. I would like to start by discussing the registration charge and can pivot to the assault charge at any point. There are three reasons why the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Heggs failed to register the restaurant, which he had properly registered as his place of employment as a secondary address. First, the state did not present any evidence that Mr. Heggs had ever stayed overnight at the restaurant, let alone stayed overnight occasionally or regularly. While it is certainly true that there is an inference that he stayed overnight the night before, one night is not the equivalent of staying somewhere occasionally or regularly. Second, if Mr. Heggs stayed overnight at the restaurant occasionally or regularly, it would have been very easy for the state to prove. The state could have called the owners of the restaurant or employees of the restaurant, or even asked SW to testify regarding what the break room is used for, who sleeps in the break room, and whether Mr. Heggs stayed overnight at the break room occasionally or regularly. But this state chose not to present this evidence. And as we heard this morning, the state has tried to switch, flip the burden onto the defense to prove who was staying in the break room. Third, while the state repeatedly claims that this room was similar to an apartment or a living space, that is not the issue in this case. The issue is who used this space and what was it used for. And again, the state chose not to present evidence establishing that it was Mr. Higgs who occasionally or regularly stayed in the room.
Well, I
In
think
sum,
what you've been describing, Mr. Erickson, is the fact that this is a circumstantial evidence case. Obviously, we didn't have a witness that said he stayed there overnight. We know that SW was a reluctant witness. But, do you acknowledge that the evidence, the circumstances proved would suggest that somebody is staying, somebody who is a man is staying on more than a, well, staying on an occasional basis in the break room, just given the photographs, the items that were found in that break room.
I would concede that some there's obviously a bed there. There's personal items, but we don't know whose those are. We don't know who the owners of this restaurant are, who else works there, what this break room was used for, who else could have used that bed, who else could have used the stuff in the bathroom. There's
And
just no connection.
why does that matter that multiple people may have stayed there on multiple on different occasions?
Yeah, because a couple reasons. First, because the state has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Higgs was staying there occasionally or regularly. And their whole argument is based on all of this stuff being there. So if somebody else was shaving in the bathroom, if somebody else was washing in the bathroom, if somebody else had their boxer shorts or clothes or jacket or was sleeping in there, that is extremely relevant to establish that there's a reasonable theory of innocence. And again, the state's investigation stopped after the search. The state could have subpoenaed the owner of the business. The state could have subpoenaed witnesses who work at the restaurant and got all this information, but they chose not to do so. So this is one of those cases where there's a giant void of evidence. And because of that void, the state is now arguing, oh, we didn't prove that all these people were staying there, when it's simply just not our burden.
And I agree with you that the defendant has no such burden, but counsel for appellant suggests that that gap between evidence that a man is regularly or occasionally staying overnight in that break room area, that gap is bridged by the evidence of your client's presence at the scene before business hours, dressed only in his underwear, by the numerous items, including a suitcase containing items personal to him and other items of mail and such strewn around, I think the language is. Why aren't those sufficient to bridge the gap and create circumstances proved that support a finding of guilt?
Yeah, a couple of things. One is, and I just want to make sure we're talking about the same part of the test. So for the first part of whether there is a reasonable inference, we are still arguing that there is not a reasonable inference of guilt. But even if we get past that and you say that there is a reasonable inference, we're talking about the second step of the state having to disprove a reasonable theory of innocence. So when you look at that suitcase isn't filled with clothing. It's not filled with anything connected to him other than envelopes from 2014. Again, a box or a suitcase full of envelopes, he can keep them there, and that doesn't establish that he has been staying there regularly or occasionally. That has nothing to do with staying there. He can use that area. He admitted, and we know that he worked there as a janitor. While we might not keep boxes of mail certain places, that doesn't establish that Mr. Heggs can't keep it there versus his primary address or a storage facility or something like that. Again, this wasn't a suitcase full of personal items. And even if it was, and the state proved that he stayed there the night before, that doesn't mean he had been staying there for multiple nights in a row or that he'd been staying there regularly or occasionally. We don't know when that box was dropped off there. Let's say he did stay there the night before and he brought all that stuff over the night before. He wouldn't be violating the statute. A secondary address isn't just staying somewhere one night. It is, you have to prove a series of nights where somebody stayed overnight, and the state simply just didn't prove that. Also, the items in the room, they were all...
Can I ask you, from a legal perspective, to meet the element of the offense, what number of days constitutes occasional?
Yeah, so in Neeson, which is an unpublished case by this court, said three days. We cited that in our brief. I think that's reasonable. So let's say the state called a witness or even asked SW, hey, has Mr. Heggs ever stayed here? And she said, oh, yeah, a couple weeks ago, he stayed here a couple nights. I stayed with him a week after that. And then we also stayed here last night. That could be reasonable, right? But we just don't have that evidence. And the state chose not to ask her those questions. And it's just unclear why. And again, it would have been very easy to ask anybody else who worked at that restaurant, hey, you need to come in and testify. We're going to ask you questions about what this room is used for.
Mr. Erickson, focusing on the second step circumstantial evidence test, what would you point us to? And maybe you started to answer this when you made reference to janitor, but what evidence in the record would you point us to that creates a rational inference inconsistent with guilt, meaning that he was not staying there occasionally?
Yeah, again, I was getting at is there were envelopes in the bedroom that were from the owners that said whatever the company's name was and a name. SW testified that she kept items in that back room. We know that him as a janitor means that he wasn't the owner of the restaurant. He wasn't making the food. He wasn't serving the tables. He wasn't doing everything. Other people worked there. And again, there's no connection between any of the stuff and him other than that box of envelopes. So again, this void of evidence doesn't result in proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The lack of evidence on that first step establishes that there's not a reasonable inference of guilt. Once we get to that second inference, I think we can look at who else had access to that room and the fact that it wasn't just Mr. Heggs who had access to the room and who could have used it. And again, it's just a complete void of evidence from any other day prior to the day where the officers arrived. If your honors don't have any other questions regarding that charge, I can move on to the assault charge. I just want to make sure I cover as much as possible in this short period of time, but I'm happy to answer more questions. All right. So under Dorn, I think that's the best case for this court to look at regarding what are the elements that need to be proved. It's not just the general intent to commit an act. So the act in this case is throwing flour in the air. The state also has to prove that that's a battery. Another means that there was force used. And in this case, the idea that flour going in the air was force upon SW and that caused her injuries. Again, there's no evidence of that. She testified multiple times.
I'm sorry, counsel. So when I look at the testimony, SW talks about that it was they had a physical fight. She wasn't exactly sure how the bloody lip happened. She said, "I don't know if I had hit something or if it was from the container, but I had gotten a bloody lip from that." And then question was, an accidental fall or did you fall because of the fighting, physical fighting? And she says, "I mean, I fell due to the flower being thrown, and you know, so it was due to the fight." I mean, as I read that, she's not 100% sure if her bloody lip was because a canister was thrown or because she fell, but in either case, it was due to or she hit it when she fell, but in either case, it was due to the fighting. That seems like a different take than there was just some flour like released in the air and someone could have slipped. I mean, she's talking about the canister or a fall during physical fighting. Why isn't that?
A couple responses. First, she never said a canister was thrown or that Mr. Hags did anything with the canister. I'm not sure if she fell on the canister. We don't know. She made it clear that she got injured from the fall. So we know for a fact that Mr. Hags didn't push her. He didn't hit her. There was no force from Mr. Hags upon SW. She said she got injured from the fall. Then the next question is, well, what caused the fall? Did she slip because she was intoxicated and hit her mouth or hit her lip on a canister on the ground? Did she
so you
hit
think
her?
The canister, when she says the flower being thrown, that like it's a reach in the flower and then somehow the canister, it's not throwing the canister is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the testimony, if you read it carefully, and I urge the court to, is that he threw flour in the air. That's it. It's not thrown flour at me.
Where is it? It's not thrown in the air. That's what she says, in the air.
Up. Sorry, it's hard when my computer versus in front of you guys with my brief in front of me. She said, and I cited to my brief, she said she threw it up. Again, there's no physical force. There's nothing. And she doesn't testify as to actually what happened that resulted in the injury. So my reading of it, and I think it's a very reasonable inference, is she's intoxicated. They're in the middle of a fight. She uses the word physical, but never admits that he never pushed her, never hit her, anything like that. Flowers thrown in the air. Something happens. She falls. She injures herself. That's all we know. And again, I'm not trying to make light of this. This is the state's burden. They have the burden to establish these elements, and they never asked these questions. They never said, "Did he throw a canister at you?" Never asked. It was thrown flour up. That's all we know. So because it's the state's burden and not the defense's burden, they have to prove that he actually inflicted the bodily harm, and there's no evidence of it. This would be an extreme extension of Dorn and Fleck to say that flour or a material thrown up in the air is force, is a battery. And then without any evidence that that item caused the injury, that the person would be guilty of inflicting bodily harm. That's a huge stretch. If you compare that to Dorn, where we know the person pushed the victim two times, and then we know the victim got injured from being burned in the fire. That is very different than here, where we don't have that first step of force, and we also don't know how she was injured.
Well, is it reasonable to infer that, as a possibility at least, of maybe one of numerous reasonable inferences, that she fell because of the flour on the floor? Is that a reasonable inference?
Let's take that as an inference that she slipped on the floor. I still don't think that's a battery under Dorn. Where's the physical force? Flour on the ground, she slips, she's intoxicated, I don't know. We don't know what happened. Again, I'm not trying to make light of someone being injured, but we just don't have enough information to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody is guilty of domestic assault when we just don't know what took place. So I would say that is not a reasonable inference of guilt, because under Dorn, I don't think that is force. And again, even if it is force, we still have to look at the other reasonable inferences. And that reasonable inference would be, during the argument, she slipped, she fell on her own, she was intoxicated, hit her lip on something, and therefore it wasn't Mr. Hags that caused the bodily harm.
But the testimony was that it was from her, as it was due to it was during the physical fight, right? Not just during the argument, but she said it was due to the fight, she described as physical.
Yeah, and as the state conceded, her testimony is very vague and kind of vacillates between what actually physical means. you know, it just because she says it was physical, she also clarified that physical was the flower. So again, the state never asked, well, did he push you? Did he hit you? So the idea that she testified that something is a physical assault or a physical argument without actually any testimony that there was force or any sort of assaultive conduct, I see that testimony contradicting itself. And again, there's no clarification what physical meant other than when she did clarify by saying it was the flower. And I also just want to touch on quickly, the state's discussion of the jury instructions is completely irrelevant to the analysis under the circumstantial evidence standard. Under Harris, the Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2016, I believe, a clear discussion that when we're discussing the circumstance proved, we defer to the jury's findings. So any sort of fact dispute, we go with the circumstance proved because of what the jury found. But that second step of looking at which inference is more reasonable, that is something the court decides based on the circumstances proved, and we don't defer to the reasonableness of the inferences. So I think it's very clear to follow the circumstantial evidence standard that has been articulated by the Minnesota Supreme Court. With that, we request that this court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you now have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel mentioned the Dorn case that he cited in his brief, and I also responded to in my reply. And the state's position is that Dorn can be analogous to this case. Taking into account State v. Lampkin, State v. Lindahl, as well as State v. Fleck, which we recently just discussed, this general intent crime, it separates the mens rea from the actus rea elements. The defendant need not intend to commit a battery, but only need intend to commit an act that would constitute a battery. And general intent crime requires only proof that the defendant intended to do the physical act forbidden without proof that he meant to do or knew that he would violate the law as a particular result. And then taking that and applying it to the evidence in this case, yes, there was flour on the floor. And yes, slipping, I believe, would meet that burden or that element. It was thrown up in the air. It was thrown at her. She had it on her face. If you take a look at the exhibits that were presented to the jury, the photographs of the scene, but also there was a sock found in the flour. A sock isn't easily dropped off the body. It's usually form-fitting on the foot. So there was some sort of physical scuffle that made that sock fall off of Ms. Wilson. Then, of course, then there's the body print on the refrigerator and that I mentioned before, but also then there's the flour that was covering the backside of Ms. Wilson as well. And what I think is particularly important with Ms. Wilson's testimony is that she was asked, was it an accidental fall? She says, I mean, and this is found at Doc 103 on page 24, I fell due to the flour being thrown, and you know, so it was due to the fight. Now, this is an uncooperative witness, and the jury saw how she reacted to the defendant in the courtroom and is in the best position to determine her credibility.
Ms. Schmidt, can I just verify if I understand the state agrees that the harm, if there was the domestic assault as a jury found, would be the bloody lip? In other words, there was no other injury from the fall. I think she clarified that. And so at least on the second circumstantial evidence test, wouldn't it be safe to say that her vacillating got to the point where essentially it could be summarized as, I don't know how I got the bloody lip. Would that be a fair assessment of her testimony that would therefore, at least from Mr. Erickson's standpoint, mean the second circumstantial evidence test has not been satisfied from the state's perspective?
I believe that could be one interpretation, and I do believe that is what the judge found in his order for judgment of acquittal on the domestic assault charge. But in determining credibility, it's more than just the black and white. words on the page, you have to take into account her physical demeanor, the jury's knowledge of domestic assault and how that could affect a witness's testimony. And then that corroborated with all of the other evidence within the photographs. Even if she slipped and fell and hit her mouth on a canister, or if a canister was coming at her, or if it was on a table, because of the general intent harm crime, the state is of the position that that would constitute domestic assault. And of course, it's beyond a reasonable doubt is the burden, but it's not beyond all doubt. I do see that I have just a brief moment. I would like to address quickly the predatory offender charge. It doesn't matter that anyone else would have stayed there in addition to the defendant. There are many cases where it was an apartment that the predatory offender was staying in that also had other people staying in there. We don't really care about the other people because they're not required to register. We care about the defendant in this case. And the suitcase, it wasn't filled with clothing. The clothing was all over the back room, including other pairs of underwear that the defendant wasn't wearing, meaning that there were many days that he stayed there. And to find the specific testimony of the BCA agent, Ms. Booth, occasional means at infrequent or irregular intervals, now and then, and that's found at Doc 105 on pages 324 and 325. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor. We would just request that the jury verdicts be reinstated. Thank you.
Very well, and thank you to both counsel. We do appreciate your answers to our questions this morning and your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You each have a good day. We'll be adjourning to consider our non-oral matters as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.